Music Session with 31509, Reel 8.
Gavin Douglas, Reel 8. You were going to tell me the story of your, this event when you were shot down.
Yes, it could have been my last flight.
Yes.
It was the first operation in the morning. We set off from base at about 7 a.m. to go and attack strongly defended Japanese positions which were holding up the British advance at a place called, in central Burma, just as it comes out of the jungle, Mount Popo, which is a sort of pyramidal hill that stands up out of the plain, quite a large hill, and rocky sides and easily defended. They were holding up a whole division, and we were asked to go in and soften them up because so that our forces wouldn't lose more casualties than were necessary. The idea of softening up the Japanese is to go in and drop 250-pound bombs on their area and to shoot them up and to completely confuse them, and of course make them an ineffective defending force until they can recover, by which time our troops would be up with them doing whatever necessary action was to take them prisoner, or if they were putting up resistance to kill them rather than be killed themselves. We carried this out successfully, in as much as we all flew away from it having carried out an attack. My aircraft in the meantime had picked up some flak, and some of it had hit the exhaust manifold of the engine, and some of the gases from the exhaust found their way into the cockpit, and I was made gradually unconscious. I can only remember really up to this point, because we were flying at about 4,000 feet above ground level, which is what we always do coming back from an operation. It was beyond the range of small arms fire from the ground, so we were safe at that altitude. They wouldn't fire their machine guns and rifles at us, because they wouldn't reach us. We were too difficult to target. So it was a safe altitude to come back. And we didn't go up high because we used more petrol doing that. So that was it. And I don't remember even beginning to pass out, because it's carbon monoxide is a poison. It renders you unconscious without you realizing that you are being made unconscious. All I can tell you about that is what the pilots told me afterwards, when I found it. Well, eventually they found me, which is quite a lot that happened. They said we were flying back, and my aircraft suddenly started to go slower and slower and slower, and it got to the stage where we hardly had flying speed anymore. They said the CO who was leading us was going so slowly we were about to call up and ask him what was wrong, for God's sake, pardon the expression, pull your finger out, we can't stay with you anymore, we're going to fall out of the air. They were chary about it. They were all thinking this and chatting amongst themselves, I've no doubt. What the hell's he doing? And all that sort of thing. I was unconscious. And they called out, and nothing happened. And then they saw my aircraft's nose suddenly dip. Subconsciously, or whilst I was going unconscious, I must have been pulling the throttle back until the engine was hardly going around at all, and the speed dropped off. And this is when the aircraft, they said the aircraft nose dropped, and then it went into a shallow dive, stayed in a fairly shallow dive the whole time, circle round, because of the torque action. I wasn't correcting on the rudder, so it started to turn, and it went on to turn as a complete half circle. And they were calling up, I know, what do you see? You know, whenever you got excited, they saw the scene, so they were going to travel with any ammunition there. No answer there. They were really puzzled. We were flying from 4,000 feet, and aircraft went into this dive. And they had to follow me down. We were in an open, wide formation. They had to do what the leader did. They were hanging back a little bit. We were no longer in a good line. It was a bit straggly because of what had happened. And they unbelievably saw, can we go on diving as though I was going to crash the aircraft? And fortunately, there was it was in the open country with paddy fields, dried up paddy fields, but a few palm trees in the paddy buns between the fields in odd places, and I happened to hit one of them with the starboard wing before it hit the ground. It tore the wing off immediately, and the aircraft then started to somersault and cartwheel head over tail across these dried up paddy fields. And on each big bounce or cartwheel, bits of the aircraft were flying off. The tail unit came off completely behind the armor plated seat. The other wing came off on the second bounce, I think. The engine broke off in front of the armor plated window, leaving just the cockpit section with me sitting in it, sliding across the fields, still rolling and turning, until it gradually slowed up with friction. And it was just so, although I was shaking around inside this like a pea in a pod, it saved my life because the deceleration was slow compared to suddenly hitting a mountainside and flying into smithereens. My safety straps inside had broken. I'd been thrown across the controls and the instrument panel, and they flew around in a circle, and they looked like they'd seen the crash, they'd seen the aircraft disintegrate in bits, and then they saw me lying still face down inside the cockpit, the right way up, funny enough, and they thought, Christ, she's headed. It's been to quite an exhibition of an aircraft going to pieces on the ground. And they flew back to base, and they said, when they were being debriefed about the operation, they said, where's Douglas? And he'd had it, and one of them, or several of them, had marked on the map the exact spot where the crash took place. Well, I knew nothing about this I learned afterwards. My remembrance is going out, carrying out the attack. I don't remember the aircraft being hit. I remember we were flying back, and I woke up on the ground. I didn't remember that part then. I was suffering from amnesia. I thought, what in the world am I doing here? I had a horrible headache. being thrown around inside that cockpit at great speeds. And I passed out several times, I remember that. Came to, but each time it got a little bit better. And I remember coming to after two or three episodes of this. I don't know how long it lasted. I looked up and I saw a ring of Burmese faces looking down at me, and time meant nothing to me. I still hadn't figured out what I was doing and why I was there. I hadn't broken anything as far as I could see, and they were very kind. They had brought some hot water from a nearby village, which I knew nothing about at the time. And they'd taken off my outer flying gauntlets, and they found the silk inner gloves inside, and they were using these to wipe with the water the blood off my face and head, which had got knocked around a bit. And this splashing of water, I think, is what brought me to. And they were all jabbering away excitedly when I came to, because they thought I was dying, perhaps, I don't know. And I began to sort of waken up a little bit. And I couldn't understand what they were saying. They couldn't understand me. And they kept on washing away this blood. It kept on coming. And it was only up here in the hairline. There's still scars, but it doesn't show. They don't show hardly now. Very super. No, nothing broken, but cracked. And split eyelid here, and that also doesn't show anymore. It had broken the bone. It's still rough underneath the skin. I can feel it. But otherwise, it was all right, except that I was had been concussed, and I had a lot of carbon dioxide in me still. If it had been pure monoxide, I'd have been dead. And how we know that I had got carbon dioxide was found out later when I got back to base, but that's another story. And they took samples of my blood and found it in the bloodstream. And they were putting the story together as to what happened. However, each time I came to, I came with it a little more than the time before. And I remember looking at my wrist for my watch to see what time it was, to see if that would help. And the wrist watch wasn't there. It was a nice Rolex, and I was all upset, and I thought one of these chaps must have stolen it, which was a very, well said, unconscious, uncharitable thing to do, because they hadn't. I'd forgotten that I'd given it to a pilot to take into Calcutta a few days earlier to have it cleaned, which it needed, which it shouldn't have needed, but it did. And I thought, well, perhaps the strap broke and it's lying in the bottom of the aircraft. And I managed to get them to lift me up, help me on the stand on the wing stub, and look down in the cockpit. Well, looking down made me feel very dizzy. And there's no floor in a hurricane. You just look down into the bottom of the fuselage. It's dark. And you see rods and cables and God knows what. And a lot of dust, usually. And I thought, I can't find it there. I had to lie down again. It went and they pulled me over and lay down on the ground. And I fell asleep again. Next time I woke up, there was a crowd around me, and there was a young Burmese girl. I noticed her, knew first of all, I realized it, I heard her voice, and she could speak English. It turned out that she was a headman's daughter from a nearby village, and she'd been to a mission school run by one of the Christian missions, and she could speak English quite well, and she was a student. A pronunciation of words and was not perfect, but she was an intelligent girl and also very nice looking. She started to speak to me, and I spoke to her. Oh, I said, what am I doing here? And she said, well, you've had a bad accident, and we all want to help you. The villagers here are very friendly, and it's been reported that Allied transport, she said lorries, I think, have been seen going up and down a road west of this, east of this position, during the last few days, which means that our forward forces were almost level with where I'd crashed, still short of where I'd come from. And the advance had brought them nearer to me. And but my squadron was still back, as it happened, at this place. Moniwa. And she said, if you are well enough, we can get you to the road. And you, maybe your people there, you will see, and they can help you go back to where you came from. Then she asked me, where did you come from anyway? And I had no recollection, complete amnesia. And they pulled the map, the big map that I flew with, out of the cockpit, which was folded, of course. And there were many track lines drawn on it in pencil, and they read out the names of various places where track lines ended. And they said, do you come from Yamasin? I said, no. Yes, I might have done. And they mentioned several other places, and the same old answer. Yes, I've been there, but I can't remember. And when they said, amongst the places, do you come from Moniwa? And that name rang a bell, rather more strongly than the others. Moniwa, yeah? Yes, I remember Moniwa. And then it came back to me that I had left Moniwa that morning, and I could see the crashed aircraft, little bits of it left beside me. And she said, well, we can get you back to Moniwa. It's only 30 miles from here, but you have to go 8 miles across paddy fields, dried up paddy fields, to the road, and we can only get you in a bullock cart, and you can't walk it, not in your condition. And now it's too late to take you there today, so it must have been midday or 1 o'clock. I'd set out at 7 o'clock in the morning, because the Japanese usually move at night in their retreat, so as not to be seen. And if you're in the road before they start their retreat, then you can hide there, so they don't see you as they go through, you'll be all right. But if you're trying to get somewhere to hide while coming through, you may meet them, and that would be very foolish. So the girl said, "I'll speak to my father and mother and see if they can, we can put you up in our village for the night." And indeed, so they were taking quite a risk. If any Japanese had come in and they'd been reported, they would have been, they would all been, their place would have been set on fire, the village would have been set on fire, and they would have all been killed. Well, I walked with them, supported by two of the men. The crowd dispersed gradually, and it wasn't a long walk, as far as I remember. Arrived at this basha in a village, which was obviously the headman's basha. It was up on stilts, as all the other houses were, about 4 or 5 feet ground, from the ground. You had to come up on little ladders, and they gave me a room, and I immediately fell asleep. I don't remember a thing until the early morning, when I was woken up by this delicious smell of them cooking their first meal of the day, which was sort of rice and bamboo shoots and chicken, sort of chicken soup, you know, kind of chicken stew. There was all sorts of vegetables in it, bamboo and everything else. And it was delicious, it smelled so good. And they brought me a bowl, and it made me feel a different person. I was starving, I hadn't eaten since the night before, over 24 hours. And so this was marvelous. I looked at the girl, I thought, "Oh, gosh, she's pretty." I've been to feel better already. And her mother, who was a sweet old soul, old little Burmese lady, she said, my mother wants to give you something." They'd been obviously talking about what had happened the previous day, and they made up a little story of their own. And the mother had a little silver ring made with a V on it, very, very simple, just a hoop which had been bent with a V in the middle. And she came up and said something in Burmese, which of course I didn't understand, but the daughter translated and said, "Mother says you have been a very lucky man, and she wants you to wear this, and it'll bring you luck." I put it on, and I wore it for the rest of the war, and I kept it long after the war, but it, like other things, somewhere got lost, and I don't know how it happened. In various moves, I moved so many, many times, and always something went astray somewhere. But they said we would, the previous night, we'll arrange for a bullock cart to take you at first light in the morning, and there'll be some straw in it for you to lie on, as it'd be uncomfortable, and also straw to hide under and get into underneath if you meet some Japanese on the way, so that you can't be seen. When I'd had this chicken broth and the first meal of the day, there it was outside waiting for me with a driver, and it looked rather comfy and cozy. I wasn't looking forward to 8 hours of bumping across paddy fields. This was no springs, but it's better than walking. And at that moment, when I was about to get into this bullock cart, that there was some kind of rumpus going on at the bottom end of the village, and they were listening, and they suddenly started talking excitedly amongst themselves and clapping their hands. And I said to the girl, "What's that?" They said, "British car has come to the village, and they're asking, with some sobs in it, and they're asking about a plane crash which took place near here yesterday. It's the wind." And almost as soon as she finished, it was only a small village, saying this, a jeep drives up. It was one of the squadron jeeps. And it was my jeep, actually, the Sears jeep. And one of the pilots who'd been flying volunteered to come with his map to help navigate across country to where they thought the aircraft would be. The squadron engineering officer was there because they were mystified about the crash. He came out to pick up the dog tags of my corpse to take back, proof of my death, and also to look at the aircraft and what was left of it, see if they could figure out from that what had caused the crash. There was no possible reason why we should suddenly go into a dive when I was flying it and crash like it did. And no sound from me, not a peep from me as to what had happened, which was because I was unconscious. And there was an army liaison officer too, who came out to make a report, and I hope make a record, so later on the villagers would be rewarded, which was a promise made. We all carried kits saying, if you will help this Allied officer, the British government will guarantee that you will be rewarded for doing so. So that was to tie things up. And as we were about to, I got in, they were flabbergasted. I don't know if it looks on their faces, or so funny. That seeing me standing, they came to pick up the bits, you see, or bit of the bits, and to see me standing up with a pretty girl by my side, and looking very fit. I wasn't, but you know, they couldn't believe it. I'd had a good night's sleep. I'd just had my tummy filled with chicken stew and bamboo and whatever else, and I was ready for an 8-hour drive, bumpy ride across Paddyfield. And I mean, couldn't think how anybody could have survived that crash from the description I got from the pilots. The plane bouncing and 20, 30 feet out of the ground, kind of crashed at speed, but each time getting slightly slower, friction and that sort of thing. So I was equally surprised, and more than that, I was delighted. It meant going back in a vehicle with soft tires and comfort. And quicker than a bullet cart by a long way. It only went 2 miles an hour, and I got back into. After all this thing, they stayed about 15 minutes. The engine near their office was taken to where what was left of the wreckage was, and he had a look at the aircraft, and he saw the cause, the punctured manifold. There were bullet holes. It wasn't twisted or burnt in any other way. And he said, well, that's one of the things that could have happened. And this was all in the inquiry after. So. And we were just about to leave when one of the natives came running forward with the aircraft clock, which he'd unscrewed somehow from the panel. And he thought I had wanted the clock the previous day when I was looking for the time. When I was looking for my watch. And he thrust it into my hand. And I thought, God, I thought these chaps have stolen my watch, and they've done this. And so I was delighted, and I kept it as a souvenir, and after the war I took it into garages in Regent Street and had it mounted on in a silver case with squadron crests on it and a little legend saying it was a souvenir of the crash in Burma on that particular date, and that I'd walked away from it. And I was put into a darkened tent for, I think, about a couple of weeks in a forward casualty station in the jungle because of concussion and the leg, and in case there were any other complications, because my skull had been a little bit damaged. And as soon as that was better, I was sent to Calcutta for a proper medical examination. Went to the medical board in Calcutta, as instructed. They was looked at by a team of doctors, and they said, you're extraordinary. You had a most remarkable recovery. And considering what happened and the report you've had, you've come off extremely lightly. It was lucky that the plane didn't stop dead when it hit the ground, because you'd have been dead too. And this skidding across and jumping in the air and flying around and cartwheeling all gradually slowed it up. And eventually, when it got onto its right side up and skidded along the ground just a bit to it like a toboggan, it didn't stop suddenly. It was a very rough ride. You hit bumps and the thing was thrown all over the place. But you shouldn't be here with that kind of accident. And you were lucky, especially as your straps had broken and you were being thrown around inside this like a rag doll. Well, they said, the usual, 30 days, sick leave, and I went down to South India and stayed with my wife, who was there at the time, very upset about the accident. But I was fine, and the worst was over. In this 30 days, I played a little golf. There was a 9-hole golf course close by. I went and did a little bit of trout fishing. There's some trout rivers, trout streams quite close by. I saw my two small sons and took them on picnics. And I went back after a month to Calcutta, where I was reboarded. And then they made their report to the Calcutta headquarters, the RAF, and I was sent for by the Air Commodore Vincent, who was in charge of 2-to-1 group, which was the group I was with, going down through central Burma, group of squadrons. And he at one time had commanded 60 Squadron in the Great War, which I didn't know at the time. And he said, "Well, Douglas," he says, "congratulations." He said, "I think you've been very lucky. But in view of the accident you happened, it would be quite understandable if you didn't go back to flying in Burma and we could find you another position." I was astounded at what he said. I feel fine, sir. There's nothing wrong with me. I'd like to go back to my squadron. And he looked at me quiet and said nothing. And then after a little while, he said, "In that case, I'll give you a squadron." A little bit emotional about it still. I couldn't believe my ears. And I said, "Oh, thank you, sir." And he said, "Well," he said, "you go to 34 Squadron, go back to your squadron, pick up your things and go over to 34 Squadron, which is now at the door, DEHDAW, and they're comprised of Thunderbolts, American P-47 Thunderbolts, and take it over as quickly as you can." I'd never flown or seen a Thunderbolt in my life. However, I did exactly and as I marched out of his office, I was treading on air. Went back to trying to fly back to Burma, rejoin my squadron. They had already received an advance signal that I was being posted to command 34 Squadron, and so they were not surprised to see me. I picked up my things. It was too late in that day to get over to Sador, so the next morning early I was flown over to Sador to join 34 Squadron. To see these great hunks of metal which flew like bricks, which was going to my future command.